Well, you know that tune, Vivaldi's Winter Lago, or as it's becoming better known, the theme music for Evening Under Lamplight. And that's where we are now, back with Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you can reach me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com. Our archives are posted at momentsunderlamplight.com. And of course, you are invited to attend. You remember that we have devoted ourselves to journey through Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, a poem from 1855, 1,336 lines long, broken into 52 sections. We're attending to the 8th section this evening under lamplight, which starts off the first big catalogue in the poem, a kind of survey of American people from all walks of life, whom Whitman observes or intersects with and accepts without judgment. What I'd like to do now is read the lines from Whitman and then wait till later to attend further to them. We'll just let them stir the air, or the airwaves, at the start of the show, and then we'll see if we can work up our own little catalogue of American people as met in various musical pieces. So first, Whitman. The little one sleeps in its cradle. I lift the gauze and look a long time, and silently brush away flies with my hand. The youngster and the red-faced girl turn aside up the bushy hill. I peeringly view them from the top. The suicide sprawls on the bloody floor of the bedroom. It is so. I witnessed the corpse. There the pistol had fallen. The blab of the pave, the tires of carts and the slough of boot soles and talk of the promenaders, the heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor, the carnival of sleighs, the clinking and shouted jokes and pelts of snowballs, the hurrahs for popular favourites, the fury of roused mobs, the flap of the curtained litter, the sick man inside, borne to the hospital, the meeting of enemies, the sudden oath, the blows and fall, the excited crowd, the policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd, the impassive stones that receive and return so many echoes, the souls moving along, are they invisible while the least atom of the stones is visible? What groans of overfed or half-starved who fall on the flags sunstruck or in fits? What exclamations of women taken suddenly who hurry home and give birth to babes? What living and buried speech is always vibrating here? What howls restrained by decorum? Arrests of criminals, slights, adulterous offers made, acceptances, rejections with convex lips. I mind them or the resonance of them. I come again and again. I mind them or the resonance of them, Whitman says, and will want to mind some more American characters and try to feel the resonance of them. Where shall we start? Let's start with the smart-ass teenager. Whitman might say something like this. I laughed with the class clown as he bad-assed the teacher, calling him Daddy-O, and I cut class with him and smoked in the room behind the auditorium and played craps down in the boys' gym. Yes, it's Charlie Brown, playing dumb and asking in mock innocence, why is everybody always picking on me?
In the auditorium, Charlie Brown, Charlie Brown, he's a clown, that Charlie Brown, he's gonna get caught, just you wait and see.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
That's him on his knees, I know that's him,
yelling 7-come-11 down in the boys' gym. Charlie Brown, Charlie Brown, he's a clown. That Charlie Brown, he's gonna get caught. Just you wait and see.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
Who's always riding on?
On me.
There was the Coasters with Charlie Brown and the great King Curtis as usual on tenor sax. Even the bass player sounds like a wise guy. The Coasters always seem to have fun doing their songs. Notice that they don't say anything about the girls he had with him in the secret places of the high school. He could do all these other things, but in 1959, let's avoid anything risque if we want to place in the charts. You could, of course, make all sorts of innuendos if you were just out for fun and not success. Here, for instance, from 1954, is Mildred Jones talking about Mr. Thrill, who resonates with his woman because of his powerful Cadillac, or something like that.
My daddy's got a long, long, long Cadillac.
Thank you.
yes, just another part of the American scene, right? And I was there next door as the guy was driving with his chick deep in the midnight hour. And I was there at the dance when the stud with speedy moves muscled in on another man's girl.
Boom, boom, boom.
But my real name is Mister. Mm-hmm. Not a y'all can call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. Mm-hmm. No, for meeting brand new fellas and taking other folks' girls. Mm-hmm. Not a y'all can call me Speedo, cause I don't believe in wasting time. Some may call me Mo. Yes, man, my Speedo, he don't ever take it slow. Well, naughty, y'all can call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. Naughty, y'all can call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. Speedo, he don't ever take it slow. Well, naughty, y'all can call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. Well, naughty, y'all can call me Speedo, but my real name is Mister. And naughty, gonna call me Speedo till they call off making pretty girls.
They'll go on calling me Speedo till they call off making pretty girls. Well, that first guy, Mr. Thrill, pleasured his women by the way he drove his Cadillac. And the second guy, Speedo, is sung to us by the Cadillacs. That's a nice little link. I've always liked Speedo, and we can just picture him full of bounce and brag. Speedo, though his real name is Mr. Earl. Who don't never take it slow. He brags to us that he's known for taking other folks' girls. That's okay, he says, because he always makes the girls change their minds. He's slick that way. Hang out on the streets like Walt Whitman, or better yet, in the dark corners of dances or bars, and you're sure to meet this guy. Can we accept him as Walt would without judgment and just appreciate his exuberant energy? Well, so much for our triptych of 1950s songs. We've been looking so far at some street people, urban people. You'll remember that Whitman begins with the people on the street and the blab of the pave, but then moves far and wide across America. We'll do that too, moving right across and northwards to the frozen Yukon at the time of the great gold rush in the 1890s, with the poem The Shooting of Dan McGrew by Robert Service. Years and years ago, I used to have a record of Service's poems read by Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd was a late-night radio broadcaster in New York who played a sort of mentor to many of us in our teenage years, tutoring us in basic skepticism about the hype of advertising and the absurdity of the modern urban world around us. Coming to us live for 45 minutes, five nights a week, talking and telling stories and sometimes playing his kazoo. I used to lie there in bed at night, a tiny transistor radio in my ear, which was just able to pick up the New York station 90 miles away. And now you can go to iTunes and download countless podcasts from Shepherd's radio shows and listen to these yourself. Among much else, Shepherd introduced us to the poems of Robert Service, Bard of the Yukon. Then, one day in a record store, I discovered that he had produced a record of his readings with piano backup and commentary on many of the poems. I bought the record, of course, and when I began teaching, I sometimes brought it into class to play for the students. One student borrowed the record. I still remember who he was, but he never returned it. I was very sorry, but look, it's not life's greatest loss, and I hope you enjoyed it, John, or passed it along to others. The shooting of Dan McGrew, as you'll hear in a moment, needs varying musical accompaniment. I remembered that Shepherd had done this well on his record. If only I could find a copy. Nothing on YouTube, nothing on iTunes. Aha! But I found it finally at the Smithsonian Folkways website. Only $9.99. That's not even $10, you see. For immediate download. I'm a little bothered by the way Shepherd slurs over the nuances and delights of the meter and rhymes of the poem, but he does wonderful things with his performance, and I hope you'll be delighted with the introduction and the poem itself.
Robert Service wrote what turned out to be, without a doubt, the most famous frontier poem of all. As a matter of fact, this poem is world-famous and has been translated in almost all the known languages and made Robert Service instantly world-famous. It was performed in vaudeville. And in fact, since it was written in the early 1890s, it practically set the whole tone of all the movie westerns to come. Many movie directors just before World War I admitted that they based their westerns on this particular poem because it has all the elements: the saloon, the lady of easy virtue, the lone stranger from out of the dark, and the evil man sitting at the card table, obviously cheating at cards, ancient wrongs that have to be avenged. And this poem is probably more performed than any poem ever in the history of the English language. It's Robert Service's absolutely unique, The Shooting of Dan McGrew. A bunch of the boys were hooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. And the kid that handles the music box was hitting a jagtime tune. Back of the bar in a solo game sat Dangerous Dan McGrew. And watching his luck was his light of love, the lady that's known as Lou. When, out of the night, which was 50 below, and into the din and the glare, there stumbled a miner, fresh from the creeks, dog dirty and loaded for bear. Oh, he looked like a man with a foot in the grave and scarcely the strength of a louse. Yet he tilted a poke of dust on the bar, and he called for drinks for the house. Well, there was none could place the stranger's face, though we searched ourselves for a clue. But we drank his health. And the last to drink was Dangerous Dan McGrew. You know, there's men that somehow just grip your eyes and hold them hard like a spell. And such was he, and he looked to me like a man who had lived in hell, with a face most hair and the dreary stare of a dog whose day is done, as he watered the green stuff in his glass and the drops fell one by one. Then I got to figuring who he was and wondering what he'd do. And I turned my head, and there, watching him, was the lady that's known as Lou. His eyes went rubbering around a room, and he seemed in a kind of daze. Until at last, that old piano fell in the way of his wandering gaze. Now, the ragtime kid was out having a drink, and
and there was no one else on the stool. So the stranger stumbles across the room and flops down there like a fool in a buckskin shirt that was glazed with dirt. He sat, and I saw him sway. Then he clutched the keys with his talon hands. My God, but that man could play. Were you ever out in the great alone when the moon was awful clear and the icy mountains hemmed you in with a silence that you most could hear, with only the howl of a timber wolf, and you camped there in the cold, a half-dead thing in a stark dead world, clean mad for the muck called gold, while high overhead, green and yellow and red, the north lights swept in bars? Well, then, you've a hunch what that music meant. Hunger and night and the stars. And hunger not of the belly kind that's banished with bacon and beans, but the gnawing hunger of lonely men for a home and all that it means, for a fireside far from the cares that are, four walls and a roof above, but oh so crammed full of cozy joy and crowned with a woman's love, a woman dearer than all the world and true as heaven is true. My God, how ghastly she looks through her rouge, the lady that's known as Lou. And then, all of a sudden, the music changed, so soft that you scarce could hear. But you felt that your life had been looted, clean of all that it once held dear. That someone had stolen the woman you loved. That her love was a devil's lie. That your guts were gone. And the best for you was to crawl away and die. 'Twas a crowning cry of a heart's despair. And it thrilled you through and through. I guess I'll make it a spread, misère, said Dangerous Dan McGrew. The music almost died away, and then it burst like a pent-up flood. And it seemed to say, repay, repay. And my eyes were blind with blood, and then the thought came back of an ancient wrong. And it stung like a frozen lash, and the lust awoke to kill, to kill. And then the music stopped with a crash. And then the stranger turned, and his eyes, they burned in a most peculiar way. In a buckskin shirt that was glazed with dirt, he sat. And I saw him sway. And then his lips went in a kind of grin, and he spoke. And his voice was calm. And, boys, says he, you don't know me, and none of you care a damn. But I want to state, and my words are straight, and I'll bet my poke they're true, that one of you is a hound of hell. And that one is Dan McGrew. Then I ducked my head and the lights went out, and two guns blazed in the dark, and a woman screamed, and the lights went up. And two men lay stiff and stark. Pitched on his head and pumped full of lead was Dangerous Dan McGrew, while the man from the creeks lay clutched to the breast of the lady. that's known as Lou. Now, these are the simple facts of the case. And I guess I ought to know. You know, they say that the stranger was crazed with hooch. And I'm not denying it so. I'm not so wise as the lawyer guys. But strictly between us two, the woman that kissed him and pinched his poke was the lady that's known as Lou.
She was the roughest, toughest, frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Hidey, 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 hidey. She loved him, though he was cocky. He took her down to Chinatown, and he showed her how to kick the gong around. Hide, 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 hide. About the King of Sweden, he gave her things that she was needing. He gave her a home built of coal and steel, a diamond car with the platinum wheels. Hadi, 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 hadi. He gave her his townhouse and his racing horses. Each meal she ate was a dozen courses. She had $1 million worth of nickels and dimes. She sat around and counted them all 1,000,000 times. Hide, 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 hide.
And there, Gene Shepherd reading Robert Service's Shooting of Dan McGrew, followed by another disreputable character, Minnie the Moocher, a song made famous by Cab Calloway. You can see his famous pre-Michael Jackson moonwalk at the beginning of the 1932 cartoon Minnie the Moocher, featuring Betty Boop and Bimbo, Betty's pet dog, also by some bestial twist, her boyfriend. He dropped out of the scene when the censorship rules got tougher. Look for the cartoon on YouTube. Well, you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. And we're looking at various people resonating in the world around us. It's a loose theme, as you've seen, but we're not very strict around here. We want to move back to Whitman's wide-ranging catalogue of types of people he reaches out to, and I thought one way to get there is through the wide-ranging catalogue of types found in that most eerie of Dylan's songs, Desolation Row. But before we get there, I always wanted to pair Desolation Row with Tennessee Williams' surreal play Camino Real, which also features a range of characters, some real, like Byron, some fictional, like Don Quixote and Kilroy. Let's spend a minute or two with Don Quixote, who enters in the prologue and sort of sets the theme of the play. The play takes place in the square of a walled town, which is the end of the Camino Real, that is, the royal road, and the beginning of the Camino Real, the road of reality, where the spring of humanity has gone dry, and where all the freaks hang out and our dreams and nightmares are enacted. Onto the stage in the prologue comes Don Quixote, dressed like an old desert rat, speaking with a cracked old voice which is still full of energy, stumbling with a fatigue which is only physical. Sancho Panza, who has been reluctantly following him, refuses to go further and wanders off. The wind moans as Quixote enters the empty plaza and, looking around, says, "Lonely." To his surprise, the word is echoed softly by almost unseen figures huddled below the stairs and against the wall of the town. Quixote leans upon his lance and observes with a wry smile, "When so many are lonely as seem to be lonely, it would be inexcusably selfish to be lonely alone." He shakes out a dusty blanket, shadowy arms extend toward him, and voices murmur, "Sleep, sleep, sleep." Quixote arranges his blanket and replies, "Yes, I'll sleep for a while. I'll sleep and dream for a while against the wall of this town. And my dream will be a pageant, a mask in which old meanings will be remembered and possibly new ones discovered. And when I wake from this sleep and this disturbing pageant of a dream, I'll choose one among its shadows to take along with me in the place of Sancho." He blows his nose between his fingers and wipes them on his shirt tail and continues, "For new companions are not as familiar as old ones, but all the same, they're old ones with only slight differences of face and figure, which may or may not be improvements, and it would be selfish of me to be lonely alone. At daybreak tomorrow I will go on from there with a new companion and this old bit of blue ribbon to keep me in mind of distance that I have gone and distance I have yet to go, and also to keep me in mind of..." And at this moment the cockatoo cries wildly, heralding the approach of dawn. Quixote nods as if in agreement with the outcry and folds himself into his blanket below the great stairs and begins his dreaming.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless, they need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row. Cinderella, she seems so easy. It takes one to know one, she smiles. and puts her hands in her back pocket, Betty Davis style. And in comes Romeo, he's moaning, "You belong to me, I believe." Then someone says, "You're in the wrong place, my friend, you'd better leave." And the only sound that's left after the ambulances go is Cinderella sweeping up on Desolation Row. Now the moon is almost hidden, the stars are beginning to hide. The fortune-telling lady has even taken all her things inside, all except for Cain and Abel and the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Everybody is making love, or else expecting rain. And the Good Samaritan, he's dressing, he's getting ready for the show. He's going to the carnival tonight on Desolation Row. Ophelia, she's 'neath the window, for her I feel so afraid. On her 22nd birthday, she already is an old maid. To her death is quite romantic, she wears an iron vest. Her profession's her religion, her sin is her lifelessness. And though her eyes are fixed upon Noah's great rainbow, she spends her time peeking into Desolation Row. Einstein disguised as Robin Hood, with his memories in our trunk, passed this way an hour ago with his friend, a jealous monk. Now he looked so immaculately frightful as he bummed a cigarette. Then he went off sniffing drain pipes and reciting the alphabet. You would not think to look at him, but he was famous long ago for playing the electric violin on Desolation Row. Dr. Filth, he keeps his world inside of a leather cup, but all his sexless patients, they are trying to blow it up. Now his nurse, some local loser, she's in charge of the cyanide hole, and she also keeps the cards that read, "Have mercy on his soul." Can hear them blow. If you lean your head out far enough from Desolation Row, across the street they've nailed the curtains, they're getting ready for the feast. The Phantom of the Opera in a perfect image of a priest. Here a spoon-feeding Casanova to self-confidence after poisoning him with words. And the phantom shouting to skinny girls, get out of here if you don't know. Casanova is just being punished for going to Desolation Row. At midnight, all the agents and the superhuman crew come out and round up everyone that knows more than they do. Then they bring them to the factory where the heart attack machine is strapped across their shoulders. And then the kerosene is brought down from the castles by insurance men who go check to see that nobody is escaping to Desolation Row. Praise be to Nero's Neptune. The Titanic sails at dawn. Everybody's shouting, which side are you on? And Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower, while Calypso singers laugh at them and fishermen hold flowers. Between the windows of the sea where lovely mermaids flow, and nobody has to think too much about Desolation Row. Yesterday, about the time the doorknob broke, when you asked me how I was doing, was that some kind of joke? All these people that you mentioned, yes, I know them, they're quite lame. I had to rearrange their faces and give them all another name. Right now, I can't read too good. Don't send me no more letters, no. Not unless you mail them from Desolation Row. Thank you.
these people that you mention, yes, I know them, they're quite lame. And it's interesting to shift from Dylan and Tennessee Williams and the others we've attended to over to Walt Whitman, who never passes by the lame people, but they are not for him part of a horror show, but part of a celebration of the multiplicity of life. It's as though he's so excited by all the different people in the world around him that he just can't contain himself. I am not contained between my hat and boots, but gathers together as many as he can. The thing about Whitman is that his excitement and his posing seem so loose that we get the initial impression that all the details are just thrown together haphazard. But there's an artfulness here that we can enjoy if we attend carefully. Look at the first set of images. The little one sleeps in its cradle. I lift the gauze and look a long time and silently brush away flies with my hand. The youngster and the red-faced girl turn aside up the bushy hill. I peeringly view them from the top. The suicide sprawls on the bloody floor of the bedroom. It is so. I witnessed the corpse. There the pistol had fallen. Notice the progression from birth, the little one sleeping in the cradle, to love, the youngster and the red-faced girl, blushing out of modesty or out of excitement as she goes with her lover to a secluded place behind the bushes. And then death, the suicide on the bloody bedroom floor. And Whitman's attitude towards these three images changes, too. He performs an action in the first scene, brushing away the flies. In the second scene, he watches, but with an excited, even voyeuristic interest, peeringly viewing them from the top of the hill. And in the third scene, he is merely the witness of the corpse. He's there, reporting what he saw, but almost frozen in horror. Then we move to the city streets, with one of Whitman's startling phrases, the blab of the pave. We know what he means, the noise of the streets, but what an odd way to put it. By now, though, we're used to his oddities of diction. A blab is not just noise, though. It usually has overtones of loose talk, which reveals secrets, reveals more than it's aware of. So the sounds he is about to catalogue are more than just sounds. They reveal in miniature a much larger human drama out there on the pave, a colloquial word for the pavement, as though Whitman's too cool to use the whole word. So let's listen to the sounds he hears. First, there's the tires of carts. Not the noise we would associate with modern rubber tires, but wooden and metal cartwheels scraping on the cobbled streets. Traffic was very noisy in those days. And there's the slough of boot soles. We perhaps think, first of all, of the word as related to scuff, so we pick up the image of footsteps scuffing or shuffling along the pave. No trainers or rubber soles in those days, but heavy leather soles, often, if these were workers, having cleats or nails in them, clicking on the stone pave. But slough is possibly a different sound, having to do with the mud on the streets, into which the boots sink a little as people try to negotiate their way along the dirt and horse droppings. And now a human sound, the talk of the promenaders. No sense of mud or scuffiness now. Promenaders are what? More dignified, leisurely, like two men walking along talking business, or a woman telling her sister about a visit she recently made to one of their cousins, or a couple maybe pushing a baby in the pram, walking along discussing their dreams of moving into a new house. Often, places were too crowded inside for any kind of quiet conversation, so you went out into the streets to continue the talk, swept up in the noise and anonymity, no one paying any attention, except, of course, Walt Whitman, standing amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary. You try it. Walk down the street and listen to the talk of the promenaders. make Whitman's four words come alive into real-life dramas for yourself. The next image I find a little difficult to picture clearly. The heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor. I can see the omnibus, we've shortened the word today to just bus, the large wooden wagon with seats inside for maybe 10 people, and then room on top for more. Not an easy vehicle to maneuver around in busy streets. I could do more research into public transport in New York in the 1850s. Perhaps then I'd find out just what the driver is doing with his interrogating thumb. I can now only guess that he spots someone approaching the omnibus and he points with his thumb to the spiral stairs at the back, asking if that person wants to climb on top. Or perhaps he's just asking if the person wants him to stop. There's no point shouting over the blab of the pave. A simple hand signal would suffice. And then the clank of the metal horseshoes on the granite floor. Where's the floor? Is the omnibus now back in its terminal, or is there a granite floor as part of the street? Perhaps a smoother pathway so the passengers don't get too shaken up by the wheels clambering over the cobblestone paving of the street. I don't know, but you see how we can still attend with possible images, holding back on certainty until the time we may come to learn more clearly what the scene may have looked like. Then finally, in this subsection, we shift to a winter scene, the carnival of sleighs, the clinking and shouted jokes and pelts of snowballs. It's snow day, and people are out in the streets to have fun in the snow. No clamor of cartwheels or horses' hooves now on the snow, but sleigh bells clinking all around. The bells enhance the carnival atmosphere, but my guess is that with the horses' sounds muffled by the snow and sleigh runners quietly swooshing in the soft snow, they needed something to warn people to get out of the way. You know what? We need that sort of thing again today. A few days ago, I was almost run down by an electric car reversing towards me. It was entirely silent, and I noticed the car only just in time. Well, without all the usual street noises, people can shout clearly to each other in this snow scene. And also, of course, when it's really cold outside, we have a tendency to talk louder, shout even. We put more energy into our vocal cords. And besides, people out on this snowy day, assuming it's early in the season and they're not too fed up with all the damn snow, as they will be by January and February, people out in the snow are happy, full of jokes. And oh yes, then the snowballs, of course. They don't make much sound, do they, except that quiet thud when they hit their target, but they're part of this carnival scene. We leave the snow behind as we come to the next series of short images, starting with two crowd scenes. First, the cheerful hurrahs for popular favorites. Maybe a political or a military hero is coming down the street, maybe a famous singer, what we would call today a celebrity. But then the opposite kind of crowd noise. The fury of roused mobs. What are they furious about? Who knows? These things happen, perhaps more in the older days than today. I can't remember when I last, if ever, saw a roused mob spontaneously forming in anger against some disgrace or abuse or perceived abuse. We see organized mobs, but a roused mob is something else. And with the super-militarized police around today, it's doubtful we'll see much of this, except the kind of mob that forms through social media. Something more sobering next. The quiet sound of the flap of the curtained litter, an older form of ambulance in which the patient is carried in a litter, a boxed-in stretcher carried by two footmen. The word ambulance, after all, comes from the Latin word to walk. The first ambulances were walking vehicles. A wheeled vehicle going along the cobbled streets would jolt the poor suffering passenger too much. Then a fight scene, always possible on the streets, perhaps more so then when times were rougher. The enemies meet, by chance or design, we aren't told. The sudden oath, the blows and fall. Whitman's not going to be specific about what their enmity concerns. He gives us a minimalist description, allowing us to build it up ourselves, as also the exact nature of the sudden oath. And of course, an excited crowd forms. Everyone likes a good fight, and then the cop shows up, elbowing his way through the crowd. The policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd. We need a pause, and Whitman pulls back with a general comment and a question about all these resonances he's been describing. The impassive stones that receive and return so many echoes, the souls moving along, are they invisible while the least atom of the stones is visible? No, they're not invisible, at least not in our imagination. It is possible for us to move from the echoing sounds and the visible stones to the souls of the people all around us. That policeman we just saw, for instance, the policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd, well, that's what's visible. Can we pick up the echoes of his soul resonating here? That importance he feels with his star, acting in his official role, conscientious as he quickly moves or quickly works his passage through the crowd, not arrogantly pushing his way through, not casually checking things out, but I imagine gently and firmly pushing aside someone's arm here or excusing himself as he pulls apart two people standing together so he can get past them, as he aims to get to the center to handle the problem. What can you tell about the soul of this man? Then Whitman returns to the little scenes with four phrases beginning what, as the echoes take us to the mystery of human suffering. What groans of overfed or half-starved who fall on the flags, that is, the stone pavement, sunstruck or in fits? What exclamations of women taken suddenly who hurry home and give birth to babes? What living and buried speech is always vibrating here? What howls restrained by decorum? Arrests of criminals, slights, adulterous offers made, acceptances, rejections with convex lips. I like those convex lips. No, I reject you. I mind them, or the resonance of them. I come again and again. Yes, Whitman minds them, is aware of them, and of their resonance, the soul within the details. I come again and again. No, it's not come in the modern sense of sexual climax. The 19th century word was more likely to be spend than come. Whitman is telling us that he embraces these resonances and seeks more of them. He never turns away from the blab of humanity. So let's listen again to the whole section. The little one sleeps in his cradle. I lift the gauze and look a long time and silently brush away flies with my hand. The youngster and the red-faced girl turn aside up the bushy hill. I peeringly view them from the top. The suicide sprawls on the bloody floor of the bedroom. It is so. I witnessed the corpse. There the pistol had fallen. The blab of the pave, the tires of carts and slough of boot soles and talk of the promenaders. The heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor, the carnival of sleighs, the clinking and shouted jokes and pelts of snowballs, the hurrahs for popular favorites, the fury of roused mobs, the flap of the curtained litter, the sick man inside borne to the hospital, the meeting of enemies, the sudden oath, the blows and fall, the excited crowd, the policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd, the impassive stones that receive and return so many echoes, the souls moving along, are they invisible while the least atom of the stones is visible? What groans of overfed or half-starved who fall on the flags sunstruck or in fits? What exclamations of women taken suddenly who hurry home and give birth to babes! What living and buried speech is always vibrating here! What howls restrained by decorum! Arrests of criminals, slights, adulterous offers made, acceptances, rejections with convex lips. I mind them, or the resonance of them. I come again and again.